So I look forward to it.
Oh, I'll be coming to you.
I'd like to call the Senate Higher Ed Committee to order today. And today we are going to go through the higher education budget and a funding overview. And Ms. Weidman is going to guide us through that today, the Senate Fiscal Analyst. So,
Madam Chair, member. There's two of us.
It's a good time to vote on something, isn't it?
There you go. Yeah.
No quorum. Sorry, Senator Brown. Although if you'd like to make a motion, we'll give it a try.
And members of the audience. I'd like to just go over a little bit the sources of funding for higher ed. Agencies that this committee has jurisdiction over and must make funding decisions about. And then just some general information. I think there have been a number of questions that have come up over the past several weeks, so I've tried to kind of touch on some of those. If we start with the first slide, that looks at all fund spending within the state budget. That looks at about 36 major funds of the state budget.
Just excuse me for just a second. There are copies of the handouts available if anybody doesn't have them. Sorry, go ahead, Ms. Weidman.
Of the total all fund spending, higher ed is about 4.6% of the total state budget. On the next page, we look at just the general fund, which is just shy of $39 billion. This is projected spending for fiscal 12 and 13. There, higher ed is about 7.6% of the budget. And when one looks historically, I know there's always a concern about the reduction in spending for higher education. And if you go back and look, in 87 and 88, higher ed was about 15% of the budget. And that was about the peak. And from there, it's been declining steadily. The next slide looks at the distribution of state appropriations by fund. And for higher education, 98% of the funding for higher ed, or about $2.9 billion for 12 and 13 projected, comes from the general fund. The remaining 2%, there's some money in the special revenue fund, and that's about $45 million. And that's primarily money from the cigarette tax that goes to the University of Minnesota for the training of medical personnel. They get about $22.3 million a year for that. There is also health care access money. That's about $4.3 million. That also goes to the University of Minnesota for the training of medical personnel. And then there's a small amount of money from the federal fund. This is money to the Office of Higher Education for various grant programs. When we appropriate money within the higher education bill, the largest chunk of money goes out to both the U and MNSCU in what's called the O&M, or Operations and Maintenance. And then that money gets further allocated out by each of the systems. And they both have formulas or different ways that they allocate their money out to their campuses and to their units. The U of M also, if you will look at their budget and bills that have been passed, there are special line items called specials, and we have specials in ag and extension, and the money on those lines has to be used specifically for the purposes specified. There's also money that goes to the Institute of Technology, to health sciences, and then there's sort of a lump sum category called system specials, which is just a number of various programs that have specific line item funding tied to them. MNSCU, just recently we have added a line to MNSCU which sort of segregates out the money for the central office. That was done last year. And then the Learning Network, which used to be administered by the Office of Higher Education, was transferred over to MNSCU, and it's now administered by MNSCU. Even though the O&M money is sort of a lump sum, The committee typically includes language within the bill that specifies what the money has to be used for. So it's not just that the systems can use it for whatever they want. So when they come in with their specific requests, for example, Minsky's request a couple of years ago was for serving underrepresented students. So within the bill, we will say this, you know, this appropriation includes money for underrepresented students, equipment, reducing tuition, whatever purposes. And then they really do have to keep track of how they use that money. Minsky has something called the green sheet, which is a very much of a line item that has each of the items that they get money for, where they specify what they use it for. And the University of Minnesota also allocates more by unit rather than particular purposes. Also, I just wanted to reference that there's always a lot of concern about, are the systems accountable? How does the legislature hold them accountable? Within Chapter 135.031, there's specific language that requires that both systems report back to the legislature in the even-numbered years as to what they did with the state appropriations. They have to report on tuition and fees that they charged. They have to report on graduation rates. There's a listing of items that they have to report to in every even-numbered year. And then also in Laws 2009, both systems were required to report to the legislature on expenditure reductions that they were going to be implementing to reach the 12 and 13 forecast base. And the use is more general. Minsky's is much more specific, where they even go down to, at each campus level, what the campuses are going to do to reduce spending. The next page, I think there are some questions that had come up looking at the relationship between state appropriations and tuition increases. So I've kind of put together two slides that look both for the U and Minsky. Where on the left, you kind of see what the appropriation levels were for each fiscal year, and on the right, you can see basically going, for example, the first dot there shows the actual tuition increase from 2000 to 2001. So you can kind of see the relationship of what was happening between state appropriations and tuition increases. And if you look at in fiscal 03, there were some pretty significant reductions to both the U and to Minsky. The U was reduced by $196 million, Minsky by $189. And in there, you will see on the right-hand side the double-digit increases that occurred as a result of some of those reductions in state appropriation. Then in subsequent years, we did also put...
I'm sorry, Senator Carlson, I was so engrossed in the slides I didn't
I
see
apologize.
That you...
I apologize. Thank you, Madam Chair. Maya, Ms. Weedman,
sorry. That's all right.
Was there anything in statute back in those years where we had the double digit? I understand the relationship between lower funding from the state and higher tuition. I get that. But was there something in statute somewhere after that, or has it always been they just had an open opportunity to do whatever they wanted to with tuition, or was there?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson. And I'll get into that a little later.
The Board of
Trustees and the U have authority to set tuition. However, there were years further down the line, for example, in 2009 and I believe in 2007, there was language put in specifically that's held the systems to tuition increases of no more than 4% per year. That was not put in statute but in the law, so right in the bill that was put in there. So it did hold them to limiting their tuition increases.
So there, I'm sorry.
Senator Carlson.
So as a follow-up, Ms. Whiteman, there's some historical reference to legislatively mandating levels of tuition increase or no increase freezes, for example?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, yes, there were.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Whiteman. I'm trying to recall, I know that we had cuts in higher education in 03 and 04, And it went into 05 a little bit, although it came back up a tad in at the U there. But why was there that big jump between 2000 and 2002 in tuition? It looks like the appropriation of the state went up, but the tuition rate really took a leap, too. Do you have any recollection of that?
Ms. Weidman?
I have to think back. Actually, the 14.4 at the University of Minnesota would have been from 01 to 02, and I'd have to go back and check on that.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's my memory, and I could be off, is that it had more to do with inflation, is that there were just costs were going up quite a bit at the higher ed institution. And I think we'd have to go back and see what the tuition rates were in the few years before that, if they were kept low and then suddenly they had to do a catch-up. But there were some high inflation years and with health care and, you know, other energy and other costs.
I believe Mr. Fuller has something to add to this issue.
Madam Chair, very little, I think. But I mean, when you have rising tuition and you look at percentages, that's a little misleading because obviously a lower percent with a higher tuition will lead to more absolute dollars. So you sort of also have to think of how much. So if you had a 2,000 level tuition in 2001, a 14% increase would be the same as a 7% increase if you had a $4,000 level later on. And so I think you have to keep that in mind to sort of, because students pay absolute dollars. So that's an important factor to keep in mind is the tuition keeps going up, a smaller percentage drives a larger tuition increase. And they were fairly low back then.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Gimsey.
When looking at that spike of 14.4 in 2001 and 2, then was there a, looking at the 14.7 in 04 and 05, was that a continuous 14% increase? The following year, then, we had another 14.5, and then the next year was another 14.6, and till we got up to that 14.7. So each of those years, we saw a 14% increase?
Madam
Ms. Weidman.
That's correct. Yeah. That's from one to the next.
Senator Scully.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gimsey, if you use the economic law, the law is 72, which is if you divide the percentage of increase into 72, it'll give you how many years to double. Right. It's 5. So over those 4 or 5 years, you know, tuition doubled.
Ms. Weidman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Also, as you see in 9 and 10, there were lower increases were reduced, and that is because the federal stimulus money was available to buy down some of those tuitions. And there was also language in the bill that limited tuition increases. So that's kind of a combination impact there. The next page basically shows the same information for the Minsky State Universities and colleges. And I think the comments I made relative to the U of M kind of comparable. The next slide looks a little bit at the distribution of student financial aid by type of aid, and I just think I found it rather interesting because if you go back 20 years, if you really look, there's been pretty significant increase in the amount that the distribution of student financial aid, but also in terms of how much investment the state has put into financial aid. If you go back and you look from like 88 and 89, the state only put in about $492 million, and if you look at 08, 09, that amount had increased to $2.8 billion, and this would be the state grant, child care grants, all sources of financial aid.
But Ms. Weidman, I'm sorry to interrupt. Could you repeat that? You said in that first graph in the 88-89, that 52% that accounts for grants and scholarships was 492? Was I hearing that correctly?
Madam Chair, the 492 is the total amount for grants, scholarships, loans, and work study.
Okay, so that's everything.
So it's total. And the 2.8 is for total. And then the percentages lay out the amount from each area, okay, allocated to each area. And there you also see the shift in terms of more loan dollars than grant dollars. And state work study, there's a little bit of a reduction there.
And Ms. Weidman, did the numbers, what were the, so if it's 2.9, you said, in 08 and 09, as I was trying to jot things down, the actual dollar amount, I can't figure it out in my head, but what were the dollar amounts on those?
I have to get you that information.
Okay, because I'd be curious as to.
I don't recall right off the top of my head what those are.
Okay, the 52 and the 39. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank
Madam
you.
Madam Chair?
Dr.
Weidman, would you just repeat the total number again?
You said 492 in the 88-89 million.
And
that was a biennial?
That was for. What was, yes, for the 88-89 uh-huh. academic years, that was
and 08-09 was 2.8 billion?
Oh, Lauren, sorry. Included. Okay.
Senator Pappas, are you going to do the math for me? Thank you.
No. I could take out my my cell phone and do it.
Thank you very much.
I do have the information.
Well, and you don't have a calculator in front of you.
What were you looking for? On this piece of paper. So.
Oh, Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Weidman, am I to understand that over that 20-year period of time that the total financial aid has quadrupled, is that correct? Or more than quadrupled, actually?
Correct.
Substantially more than quadrupled. Does that mean that the tuition then has more than quadrupled? Otherwise, why would we need this much financial aid?
That, I think.
Ms. Weidman.
I guess I haven't actually looked at it that way, sliced it that way. I think it's, and this reflects not just, Madam Chair, Ms. Senator Carlson, this is not just state investment. This also includes federal Pell Grants and things like that. So it's and state and federal loans. It includes all those things.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then as a follow-up, are we going to have another slide that shows that what that tuition was over that 20-year period of time so we can, if in fact that actually quadrupled in 20 years?
Ms. Weidman.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I can get that information for you.
I think that would be helpful.
I don't know what those numbers are off the top of my head.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other thing that would play into the center is the number of students.
Excellent.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, there is another thing that comes to mind, though I think I may still be able to get the data for you, is that in 91 we merged. Well, first of all, the technical colleges became a part of MNSCU in 91 with the merger, and so it may be difficult to go back to those earlier years because the technical colleges were under the school districts. So one would have to look at just the community colleges and state universities
Senator Roebling.
Well, just to add to this discussion, sometimes you wonder, did the tuition go up and then the aid follow, or was the aid increased and might have encouraged the tuition to go up? And, you know, sometimes you have this chicken and egg thing going on, and we've heard that discussed in childcare, too. Sometimes you question whether things don't increase because it's being subsidized. So it's easier for the seller of the service to increase their rates because they know the impact isn't as great on the consumer because it's being subsidized. And I never know which comes first. I mean, this is a huge increase in aid, but we also know that tuition doubled in 10 years, too. So, but this is even a bigger, like you said, this is like quadrupling. So it's an interesting question.
Senator Pappas.
I think someone may challenge me on my math, but it looks to me like there was a six-fold increase. So would that be 600%? It's my daughter who's the algebra whiz.
Madam Chair.
Almost 6%. Almost 6%.
I think another thing here is that this is looking at 20-year period, whereas with the tuition and fee increases, that's just a 10-year period.
Okay,
so there are some differences there as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not accounting for inflation, so I don't know exactly what the inflationary rate was over the last 20 years.
Yeah. Well, it's not in your little phone there. You can't control it.
Phone wasn't helpful.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. Thank you for Ms. Weidman, I'm sorry.
Just as some examples, and again, this isn't for the same time period, but if we look at funding for the state grant program in 1988, it was about $63 million, and now it's about $144 million. Child care went from about $2 million in 1990, and now it's at about $6.7 million. So, again, that's for a smaller time period, but it does give some sense of an interest in providing financial aid to students and helping them pay for their costs through that as opposed to just distributing money directly to the systems.
That was 10 years.
Senator Pappas?
Sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, that's correct. The next slide just provides some information for members. Again, this would be from fiscal 0 to 10. Enrollment and tuition increases at the University of Minnesota. In fiscal 2000, if I remember correctly, this is Twin Cities campus. I think it was about 4160, and currently it's about just a little over $12,000 for the 10-11 academic year. The next slide, I just wanted to reference a little bit about the University of Minnesota governance. The university is governed by a 12-member legislatively elected board of regents. There are 8 regents. Each of them represents one congressional district, and then the remaining 4 members represent the state at large. There's language within statute that requires that a student must be a member of the Board of Regents, and that student represents the state at large. The regents are selected at staggered 6-year terms, and I believe on the 13th of this month, the Regent Candidate Advisory Council just came out with their recommendations for the 4 regent positions that the legislature will be dealing with within the next couple weeks, actually.
Yes, and Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, and I believe there's at least one regent candidate in the room, Tom Devine in Congressional District 2, and I don't know if there's any other regent candidates here.
I
hope
any,
that
Senator
members
Pappas.
Are making time in their calendars to meet with these candidates because it's a really important decision that we have to make.
Thank you. And we will be working on that later this month in the next couple of weeks is to be sure. Setting up a joint House and Senate hearing on the candidates and then obviously to the joint convention for the final vote. But we are in the process of securing dates and, you know, we have to deal with the House. So we're trying very hard to make that work. Ms. Weidman.
Basically, the authorities that the university have are laid out within the charter. And within that, they are authorized to appoint professors. And actually, when I went back and looked at it, it was kind of interesting. There were some things in it I had kind of forgotten about. It authorizes them to appoint professors set their salaries, and there's actually language in there that says that they are authorized to set their salaries, provided that the salaries thus determined shall be submitted to the legislature for their approval or dissent. And I don't know that that has ever actually happened. That language is in there.
That's funny.
They also are authorized to set tuition and spend the revenues they get. There's also language in there that says that the regents are supposed to report annually to the legislature on the progress of the university and its departments, the course of study, the number of professors and students, the amount of expenditures, and other information they deem appropriate or that may be required of them. And there's also language in there that says that the Legislative Assembly may at any time alter, amend, modify, or repeal this act. So I think nothing's ever been done, but the language is there.
But now you've pointed it out to us, so we
yeah.
Just providing information, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
The next slide provides enrollment and tuition increase information for the Minsky institutions. For the enrollment, I've just kind of grouped the two-year and four-year enrollments together. Again, the FYE enrollment looks at enrollment in terms of credits generated. So if we look at just looking at students in terms of bodies and not duplicating the count, we have just about 267,000 students enrolled at Minsky institutions. And if we look at that in terms of number of credits that are generated by those students, it comes down to about 155,000 students, full year equivalent. The next slide looks a little bit at Minsky governance. Minsky is governed by a 15-member board appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. 8 members represent the congressional districts, and the remaining members represent the state at large. 3 of the members on the board have to be students representing each of the institutions that make up Minsky. So it's one from the state university, one from the community college, and one from the technical college. And the trustees also serve staggered 6-year terms.
And I know, just not to interrupt, but I know that there are some confirmations that will be coming in front of our committee very soon, too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next slide, I just pulled out of statute the powers and duties that are given to the board. You can read them for yourself. I won't go through that. Minsky board is also somewhat unique in that they have authority to negotiate contracts with the faculty bargaining units. So it's IFO for the state universities. Minnesota State College faculty is the 2-year college faculty bargaining unit. MUSAF is a state university bargaining group, and they also bargain for the personnel plan for the Minsky administrators. In doing this negotiations, they have to follow all the same processes and procedures that MMB uses in negotiating contracts with AFSCME and other state employee groups. And all these contracts are reviewed and approved by members of the Committee on Employee Relations and are then approved by the legislature. And, you know, at this point, or the subcommittee basically can look at contract provisions. All that is basically on the table for the subcommittee to look at and add to or make comments on. The next slide is a little bit about the Office of Higher Education, which this committee also makes decisions about budgets for them. Most of the money within the Office of Higher Education, about $288 million, is for the state grant program. And that's out of about $379 million. Then there's also money for work study, MinLink, Minitex, those are library services, tuition reciprocity, child care, as I mentioned, that's about $6.5 million a year, college savings plan, the Achieve Scholarship Program, which is was instated by Governor Pawlenty. It's a scholarship program for students that take academically challenging courses in high school. The average state grant in fiscal 9 was about just shy of $1,700. And in the 08-09 academic year, Minnesota ranked about 9th in the U.S. in terms of need-based undergraduate aid per undergraduate FTE student. And that average amount is about $476. This committee also provides about $2.7 million. This was in 10 and 11 to the Mayo Medical Foundation.
Excuse me, Ms. Weidman. Excuse me for just a minute. I believe that Chair This would like to introduce us to an honored guest today.
Thank you, Chair Fischbach. A pleasure to be here today after a long period of time, 7 months. The board deliberated this afternoon, and I'm pleased to introduce to you our Chancellor designee, Stephen Rosenstone. The board had a lot of discussions. We asked many tough questions, and many thanks to David Olson and the Search Advisory Committee that forwarded a list of candidates. We had two excellent candidates, but the board decided on Dr. Rosenstone, and I'm pleased to introduce him to you.
Well, thank you so much for bringing him by today. We really appreciate it. And newly designated chancellor designee, I guess. If you want to say a few words, we would be happy to have you today in front of the committee.
Well, thank you, Chair Fischbach. It's a great honor, though less than an hour old, to have this title of chancellor-to-be, if you will, of the Minsky system. We moved here nearly 15 years ago with three young kids in tow. They all learned how to ice skate right here in Minnesota. And Minnesota's become our home and will be our home for still a very long time, we hope. I fully understand the challenges that higher education is confronting and that our state is confronting, and fully appreciate the responsibilities that this board is asking me to assume, and have a full understanding of how important the vitality of higher education, the vitality of this system in particular, is to communities and businesses across our state, and how much the vitality of our state in the long run is going to depend on having a very educated workforce prepared for the global economy, the knowledge economy of this century. There's a lot of work we need to do to ensure that the education we're providing our students is second to none in this state, and to ensure that we're using the precious resources that the people of Minnesota give us in a very effective way and efficient way, so that those dollars are really going to education and not other things. I look forward to both working with this committee and other members, but also working in a new way with the other system in the state of Minnesota. I think deeper collaboration across our systems to think collaboratively about the future of higher education is long overdue. I've had a preliminary conversation with President-elect or designee Kaler and suggested this should be a top priority for both of us, and want him to be a partner in this endeavor. I look forward to the occasion when we can have more formal conversation, lots of questions. I suspect they'll be easier than the questions I've been subjected to over the last couple days. As I told Chair Thiss at the beginning of this process, whoever's left standing at the end of the game gets the job. And I guess I was left standing, though it was a close call. I was pretty tired last night. So I look forward to your counsel. The next months will be a period of intense and very broad listening, both in communities around the state, businesses, students, faculty, staff, members, and other leaders who have a deep concern and stake in higher education. This is a time when we need to think very creatively and imaginatively about how we're going to do things differently and do it in a way that's going to promote excellence and really serve the good people of Minnesota. So I look forward to those conversations. I look forward to counsel from you and other members of your committee. I look forward to a very vibrant and powerful future in a way that we will advance the important needs of our state.
Well, thank you so much for coming by, and I won't ask if there's any questions because I don't want to put you on the spot today with your new position
is
being
that,
an hour
me, is that
old.
A long-term promise that you'll never put me on the spot?
Where do I sign? Chancellor, I didn't say that. But I do sincerely appreciate you coming by. It's certainly our honor to have you have you come and say hello to us within an hour of your election. So thank you so much.
I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Chair Fischbach and members.
Thank you. Ms. Weidman.
Okay, going back with Mayo, the $2.7 million is divided up. Part of it goes to support Minnesota residents who are in the medical school there, and they get about $14,545 per year to help reduce the cost of their tuition. And there is also money that gets used to support family practice residents who practice in rural and underserved areas. There is also the Higher Ed Facilities Authority. This is basically a board that issues tax-exempt revenue bonds that helps primarily private colleges and universities get better rates for building facilities on their campuses. And within statute, we just increased their authority to issue revenue bonds, and that was increased, I believe it was $800 million up to $1.3 billion, if I remember the numbers correctly off the top of my head. I just thought on the next slide I'd kind of mention the private colleges and universities. They do educate a large number of students within the state, and these are both the nonprofit as well as the for-profit career schools. Although there is no, you know, direct appropriation to these institutions, the students that attend the nonprofit schools like McAllister, Carlson, and so forth, and the career colleges are eligible to receive financial aid. So they receive the state grant. They are eligible to receive child care grants, work study. And those institutions do have to be licensed or registered by the Office of Higher Education. So they do have to meet certain standards for the courses that they offer, their faculty. They have to participate in the federal Pell Grant program. That's a change that we made relatively recently within statute. There are some institutions that were grandfathered in that are very small schools, and they are not required to participate in the Pell Grant program. There was a lot of discussion over the past several years about that. So.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Weidman, could you explain, just because I'm so new here, it sounds like there's and I don't want to say penalty, but there must be some reason why a private school doesn't want to be participating in the Pell Grant program. So could you just explain that just briefly, just for maybe those of us that are brand new, why wouldn't they, or explain the Pell Grant program a little bit, maybe just.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, the main reason, and I see Ms. Grimes popping up her head, she may be able to explain it in more detail, but in general, in order to participate in federal financial aid title programs, you have to go through a lot of federal requirements, and the feds look at what you're doing, and there is a cost associated with that, and some of the smaller schools feel that the cost is just too excessive for them to go through the process. And Ms. Grimes may want to add to that, but in general, it's a cost factor.
Ms. Grimes, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, there are some very small career schools such as cosmetology schools and truck driver training schools that do not choose to participate in the federal Pell Grant program because to participate in the federal Pell Grant program, you have to be accredited by an accrediting agency that's recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. And the estimated cost to get accredited and stay accredited, to get accredited, the estimated cost is a minimum of $20,000 a year, and to stay accredited, it's $10,000 a year or so. And for a school that may have only 30 or 40 students, that may seem like a very steep expense.
Madam Chair, members.
Ms. Weidman.
I'm not going to go into detail on this. This might be something that in the future members would want to have a hearing about, but when I started out, I referenced that both the University of Minnesota and Minsku have specific allocation models that they use in terms of distributing the state dollars out to their campuses and to their units. Minsku has an allocation framework where the largest chunk of money goes out as a sort of a base allocation, and each institution gets money for instruction, administrative and student services, facilities, libraries, research and public services. And in developing that framework, that's been done. I think they began the process like in about 1998, 99, 2000, and it's sort of been an evolutionary process. There's been a lot of input from presidents and other staff in developing the model. They then also have some priority funds, which basically, they set aside money for initiatives that are of interest to the board or to the legislature. And then there are some set-asides for some costs, such as debt service, services that they get from the Attorney General's office. And they're currently are going through a process where they are re-looking at how that allocation framework will be handled, so that again, that might be something for further discussion at a further meeting. The University of Minnesota has a budget compact process where they basically have a compact with each of their units where there are specific goals that they have to work towards, and then money gets distributed out. The University of Minnesota does a bit more of mixing the tuition revenue with the state appropriation revenue. So it's a little bit of a different process that they use for allocating things out. Is there any other questions that completes my presentation?
Senator Peterson.
If I could have you back up a little bit. You made a comment a few slides back about how the legislature was to approve or deny the salaries of the professors at the U of M. Is that an accurate restatement of what you said there?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Weidman.
Senator Peterson, that was taken out of the university charter.
It was taken out?
I mean, it's within the university charter. That's right, the source.
So does the staff or any senators that have been here longer than I, which is a lot longer, obviously have a sense for why that is not being done? Or
Ms. Weinman?
Madam Chair, Senator, perhaps it has never been asked for. I don't know.
So what would be the process for a junior senator from St. Cloud to ask for that privilege? To if that's in the charter, you know, what would be the process we go through, or how do we get that back in the process for what the legislature should be doing?
Madam Chair, Senator,
Senator
one or just makes the request.
Okay, thank
Senator
you.
Senator Peterson. Are there any other questions? If there are no other questions, we don't have any other business in front of the committee today, but we wanted to be here to meet the new chancellor. I hope that we did have some information available to you, and I appreciate all of you coming. So we will, if there's no other questions, one more call. Then we stand adjourned.
People always ask me, do you have a law degree? Are you going to be a legislator? I said, no, you just have to get elected.
I should.
Oh, yeah.